WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's program, we're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian crisis with two journalists, one Israeli, the other a Jordanian of Palestinian origin. Earlier, we heard from Danny Rubenstein, who's on the editorial board of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. My guest Rami Khoury writes a syndicated political column called A View from the Arab World. He's also the former editor of the Jordan Times, one of the newspapers which carries his column. We phoned him early this morning in Amman, Jordan, where he lives. Arafat was at the meeting yesterday in which there was an agreement that both sides would try to push for a truce. How much authority or control does Arafat have now to influence the people in West Bank and Gaza?
He has quite a bit of authority and control, but he doesn't have absolute authority. He certainly can make a strong plea, and the people directly under his control, he can tell them to do this or do that. But this is a situation in which people are expressing very strong emotional spontaneous sentiments. The Palestinian people who are demonstrating and resisting confronting the Israeli troops and tanks are not doing it because anybody told them to go out in the street and do it. I mean, this is slightly, I think, racist almost on the part of Israelis and Americans who say things like, why does Arafat send the children out, or why doesn't he tell them to stop fighting? Assuming that, you know, Palestinians are like Ottomans, you can turn them on and turn them off. You know, people weren't saying that about the Serbian people in the streets. They weren't saying that about the people who resisted the tyranny in Eastern Europe and Russia and rose up in a spontaneous rebellion. And you have the same situation in Palestine. There are elements who will respond to Arafat and elements who will not.
I think there is an impression that Arafat is now seen as too conciliatory and that he's lost some of his credibility among some of the Palestinian population because he's seen as making concessions with the United States and with Israel. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Yes, there is. He has lost a lot of credibility in recent years. He's a very complex figure. You know, he's sort of a George Washington, sort of gone to the edges. He's widely respected among Palestinians as the person who almost single-handedly led the Palestinian national movement for 30 or 40 years, and he's done an amazing job of not letting the Palestinian issue disappear. At the same time, he has entered into this Oslo peace process that many Palestinians are worried about. They think it's going to leave them with a bunch of little Bantustans and Palestinians on closed reservations separated from each other by Israeli military roads. So there's a lot of concern among many Palestinians about the peace process that Arafat is engaged in. There's also concerns that he is not being as democratic or transparent as we would like him to be, and that there's a lot of corruption and typical third world kind of accusations. But at the same time, he is the, he's, as they say, he's the man. He's the one who does have international legitimacy, does control money and the security forces under him. So he's good and bad at the same time. But the reality is that people negotiating with him do not have the option of choosing who to negotiate with. If the Israelis have a leadership and the Palestinians have a leadership, those are the people that have to be dealt with.
Since the current intifada can lead to a more hardline anti-peace government in Israel, can the intifada be seen as very counterproductive for the people living in West Bank and Gaza?
No, I don't think that's a fair assessment. The history of the peace process, especially since the Oslo process started in 1993, the history has been that when you get violence or extremism by both sides, whether it's Jewish-Israeli terrorists or Palestinian terrorists or people on the street, and in both cases we've had violence, and it tends to bring the peace talks to a halt for a very brief period of time. It may be a few days, it may be a few weeks, but what it tends to do is reinforce the realization by the majorities on both sides that violence is not an answer, that the answer is to complete the negotiations and to complete the disengagement, to get the Israeli occupation off the backs of the Palestinians, let a Palestinian sovereign state emerge, living peacefully side by side with Israel and give Israel the recognition and security guarantees that it legitimately requests. So I think the Intifada is very much a powerful expression of the real sentiment and will of the Palestinian people. And remember, they're calling this the Intifada for Independence. This is a bunch of people running around Palestine, Arab Palestinian people, saying basically, "Give me liberty or give me death." And that should ring bells with American people. These are people who are not fighting because they like to fight. They're fighting because they've sustained the second longest military occupation of the 20th century. Only the Japanese occupation of Korea was longer than the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I think there is a strong sentiment among Palestinians and all Arabs that we need to get the occupation ended and the emergence of a Palestinian state living peacefully with an Israeli state.
I'm wondering if this got much reaction in Jordan. A sheikh who is a leader of the Hezbollah, the radical Muslim group, has called on his people to take knives and stab Israelis to death when they come across Israelis. And statements like that, I think it's fair to say, are really fanning anti-Semitic sentiments. Not only in the Middle East, but I think that's kind of spreading out to other parts of the world. I'm wondering what kind of reaction those comments got from people in Jordan, if you've heard any reaction to that.
I haven't heard any specific reaction to that specific quotation, but I think it is woefully unfair, both politically, morally, and historically, to take that kind of quotation out of context and just say, well, look what Hezbollah is saying. If the guy, whoever the sheikh was who said that, didn't say that out of the blue. He said that after, over 100 Palestinians have been killed and the Israelis have used massive military overkill against largely unarmed and largely young Palestinian kids. So we're involved in a war, and in a war situation, this is what people say. There are certainly people in the Arab world who will go around saying that we need to, you know, perpetually fight the Israelis and never live with them, as there are people in Israel who are saying that the Arabs only understand force and we have to keep killing Arabs. I heard somebody on Israeli TV, a young Israeli man, saying we have to keep killing the Arabs until they understand that this is our land and they have to live with us on our land. So both sides are doing terrible things, and neither of these actions that are being done by both sides, the lynchings, the burnings, the racist, the violence, none of this can be justified in any way. But what you're dealing with is the result of a mob psychology in a context of warfare on the ground, in the larger context of two people, the Jewish people and the Israeli people and the Palestinian people, who have had traumatic modern histories of different kinds. The Jewish experience in history is rather more traumatic, perhaps, on a longer scale in intensity than the Palestinian one. But the result is, in the end, today you have Israelis who are worried about their future existence in what they consider to be their country in Israel, and we're telling them, we will live with you in your country in Israel if you also live with a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians are concerned about their survival in what they consider to be their own country in Palestine. These are two people who are existentially traumatized by the prospects of not being able to know if their children are going to be able to live in this land, or if they're even going to be able to wake up tomorrow and find themselves alive or dead. I mean, these are really difficult psychological perceptions that you have on both sides. And in this context, you're going to get outrageous statements being made by people. And I think you have to weigh those statements very carefully.
My guest is Rami Khoury. He writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World, and he's the former editor of the Jordan Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Rami Khoury is my guest. He's joining us by phone from Amman, Jordan. He writes a syndicated weekly political column called A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor of the Jordan Times. I think that some Israelis and other people around the world wonder if there are Arab states that still want to try to get rid of Israel, that still haven't accepted Israel and would like to see the end of Israel.
Well, probably to the same extent that there are people in the United States who would like to get rid of the People's Republic of China. you know, you have an official relationship with the People's Republic of China and trade and ambassadors, but there's a lot of Americans who refuse to talk to Chinese, who think it's a terrible autocratic government that runs labor camps and sweatshops and whatever. So, yes, there are people, of course, in the Arab world who say, look, we can never live in peace with an Israeli state because they've taken the land of Palestine and whatever. But these are almost certainly a small minority, like there is a small minority of Americans who don't want to, you know, coexist with the government in Beijing. The majority of Arabs have clearly made it, have clearly stated that they would be perfectly happy to live alongside an Israeli state, but only on the condition that Israel also accepts to live alongside a Palestinian state and find an acceptable and fair resolution to the Palestine refugee issue. I mean, the problem between the Arabs and Israel is not one of perceptions that because they're Jews or we're Arabs or we're Christians and Muslims or they're Jews or whatever. It's not an ideological problem. It's a real problem of human life and dignity and survival. There's now about 7 million Palestinians, of whom around 4 million are living outside of Palestine, and they feel they were thrown out of their homes in Palestine, like the people were thrown out of Kosovo by Milosevic, and they want to go back, like the people want to go back to Bosnia, and the Americans, with the Dayton Agreement and the war in Serbia, are insisting that refugees must go back to their countries. Well, Palestinians are saying they have that same right, too, enshrined in UN resolutions, and we need to solve that problem. Now, obviously, not all 4 or 5 million Palestinian refugees are going to go back to Israel, but some fair resolution of the problem needs to be done, and this is why we still have this fighting going on in Palestine this week. And the intensity of the international diplomacy that was brought to bear to bring about the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, I thought, was pretty impressive. I mean, I can't remember any situation in the last 40, 50 years when you had so many top world powers and leaders personally getting involved in trying to mediate in what is a rather small little territorial dispute in a little corner of the world. But obviously the impact of this little dispute reverberates on the oil markets and the stock markets and security issues in terms of violence against Arabs and Israelis and Jews around the world. So it's an issue that needs to be addressed more diligently, more equitably. And I think the majority of people in the Arab world certainly are willing to live with Israel, as the majority of Israelis now say they're willing to live with a Palestinian state. We just have to finish that negotiating process to bring about the reality of an Israeli and a Palestinian state living side by side with equal rights.
You are a syndicated political columnist. You write a column called A View from the Arab World. You also host a TV program. How do you see your job? How do you see your role, your importance as a journalist in crisis times like this?
Well, that's a good question because it's a question I have to grapple with all the time. And in the last couple of weeks, it's been fascinating for me and also very difficult because I see my role as both expressing the views of my people and my society, which is Jordan and Palestine. I'm a Jordanian national of Palestinian origin, and I see myself as a binational. I see myself as a Jordanian and a Palestinian national at the same time. And I see my job as partly to manifest the sentiments that people feel and to express them in ways that can be communicated to a global audience, because I write in English. And also, I see my job partly, though, as stepping back a little bit from the fray of day-to-day events and the emotional pressures and trying to look at more constructive means of how do we get out of this maelstrom of emotion and violence and tension. I don't want to just fuel the flames of emotionalism and violence, but rather to analyze why this is happening and to suggest ways it could be changed. And just today, my weekly column, I suggest ideas that both Israelis and Palestinians could do to cool down the tensions and the rhetoric and to try to get the process back. And I'm hoping that this column I wrote today, I expect it to be published in Israel so more and more Israelis can see it. And of course, on the internet, people can see it too. But I see my job as both being an advocate of my own political culture, but and also being somebody who tries to promote reconciliation between my culture and the people with whom we have a conversation.
What are a couple of the suggestions you make to Palestinians and Israelis in your in today's column?
Well, the first one is not to use the mass media as a means of dehumanizing the other. I mean, seeing the Palestinian and Israeli leaders on CNN calling each other's names really is pretty pathetic, I think. I mean, both sides really should be ashamed. This is, you know, the mass media, CNN and Al Jazeera and BBC and the various Arab satellite stations and whatever, are very good for selling dog food advertising or for entertaining people, but they're not very good as a tool of conflict resolution. So they should cool down this rhetoric on the global airwaves. The second thing is they should stop using ultimata and threats and setting these preconditions and realize that these kinds of conflicts only get resolved when both sides simultaneously and mutually take those steps that must be taken to tone down the level of the rhetoric and bring down the level of the actual violence and confrontations at the street level. A third thing they can do is to understand the lessons of what happened. I mean, the Israelis need to be much more sensitive now in retrospect to what the Al-Haram al-Sharif, or the Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, which are built on the area that the Jews, the Israelis, know as their Temple Mount. The Israelis should be much more sensitive now to what this site means to Palestinians and to Arabs and to Christians and Muslims. That this site, the place where Sharon went in September 28th that sparked the violence, this is not just a normal religious site. This is the most dramatic symbol of national identity for the Palestinian people and one of the holiest religious symbols for Muslims all over the world. So Israelis need to be more sensitive to that, and people on the Palestinian and Arab side, for instance, need to be more sensitive to the things that are really important to the Israelis. For instance, one of the things I've learned recently is that how important it is for Israelis that incitement, what they call incitement against Israel, in the mass media, in the textbooks, these things are really, really important to the Israelis, and we need to be sensitive to that. And to hear what they're telling us, and they need to be more sensitive to what we're saying and to hear what we're telling them. So these are some of the ideas that I've been suggesting. And another one is that we need to look at the bigger picture. I mean, okay, there's kids with stones and Israelis with machine guns killing each other at certain junctions in a few places in Palestine and Israel. The bigger picture is that we can stop this by ensuring that we have sovereign Israeli and Palestinian states living side by side with completely equal rights. We can't have a resolution of this problem that requires the Palestinians, first of all, to go back to their homes and to make statements that that give Israel everything that Israel wants, and only then will the Israelis do things that respond to Palestinian rights. This is a conflict of two people who see themselves as states, as nations, as national communities that want and deserve to manifest their identity in sovereign states.
Rami Khoury writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World and is former editor of the Jordan Times. He spoke to us early today from Amman, Jordan. This is Fresh Air. Rami Khoury is my guest. He writes a syndicated weekly political column called A View from the Arab World. He's a former editor at the Jordan Times. He's based in Amman, Jordan, and he's speaking to us from Amman by phone. Palestinians who think that Arafat have been too conciliatory seem to be turning toward more radical groups like the Hezbollah. And I'm wondering if there's concern in other Arab countries, in your country of Jordan, for instance, that if Hezbollah becomes more powerful in Gaza or the West Bank, that its power will gain in other countries as well. And what would the reaction in those countries be?
I think there is a danger that the militant groups would become much more popular, but I think it would also be a rather natural occurrence in a way. If the people who are advocating peaceful resolution and negotiations and coexistence are unable to stop the deterioration of the Palestinian condition under Israeli occupation, if the Palestinians find that trying to make peace, as Arafat has done, is not ending the occupation, is not ending the destruction of Palestinian houses or the uprooting of Palestinian olive trees and the killing of children that's going on, if people are still going to keep suffering in Palestine, then at some point people are going to say, hey, this isn't working. And what is working, they look around, they find out that the Israelis unilaterally withdrew with their tail between their feet in Lebanon, in South Lebanon, in the middle of the night, because Hezbollah was attacking them militarily. And many people will say, look, maybe the only way to get the Israelis to withdraw is to attack them militarily. So this is and the Jews, the Zionists, the Israeli groups themselves used it in the 40s against the British and against the Arabs to sow terror and to create mayhem and to get their independent Israeli state. So there is a historical legitimacy to armed struggle up to a certain extent. But today what you're seeing is people insisting, still trying to resolve this problem through political negotiation, peaceful negotiations. But if it doesn't work, at some point they will look to Hezbollah and Hamas and other groups who use bombing and military means, and they will follow their lead to an extent. And this is something that we've seen in the last 2-3 weeks. If you look around, you see rallies all over the Arab world, and more people are holding up pictures of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese group. It's not a Palestinian group. And the supreme irony is that Hezbollah and Hamas did not exist, 20 years ago. These groups were formed to fight the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and South Lebanon. These were groups that were created as a byproduct of the Israeli occupation.
You live in Jordan, and Jordan has a large population of Jordanian citizens of Palestinian descent and of Palestinian refugees, many of whom are in refugee camps in Jordan. King Abdullah was at the conference at Sharm el-Sheikh. What is his position now on the current clashes?
Well, Jordan has had a pretty consistent position on the issue of Palestine for many years. I mean, Jordan as a country consistently says that it supports the Palestinian cause. It criticizes Israel, blames Israel for the violence and the problems that are taking place now. It wants Israel to withdraw from all the occupied territories according to UN resolutions and live with a Palestinian sovereign state next door, with Jerusalem as the capital of both Israel and Palestine. So there's been a pretty clear, consistent Jordanian position supporting these Palestinian demands and rights. The longer-term issue is, what are the implications for Jordan when you get a Palestinian state emerging, living side by side with Israel? Because you might get a lot of Palestinians leaving here. Jordanian citizens who are Palestinian in origin might go to Palestine. They might send their money there. Foreign aid might decline to Jordan if it's a peaceful region and Jordan is not seen to be needing so much foreign aid anymore. There's many, many implications on the economic, the national identity level, the political stability level, and these are issues that Jordan is interested in discussing and wants to be involved in the final status negotiations between Palestine and Israel, because it's really important and legitimate national interests are involved here, and it has a right to make sure that it can protect its national interests.
King Abdullah is one of several leaders in Arab countries now who is of a younger generation. There's also a younger leader now in Syria, Morocco. Do you think that there's any fundamental differences that the younger generations are bringing to their leadership styles and to what they consider to be their main concerns?
I think there is a difference with the younger generation, but I don't know if it's the generation itself that's bringing about the difference, or if it's just the fact that these young leaders took over at a moment when most of their countries were experiencing really serious political and economic and environmental and population stresses and other kinds of internal problems. The need to liberalize politically is something that many of them feel. The need to keep undertaking severe economic adjustment is something that everybody is having to live with. Environmental concerns have to be addressed, especially water and arable land, population pressures, and just adjusting to the new parameters of both a global economy and also a region that is changing, because some people now have, like us in Egypt, have relations with Israel. We can trade, we can travel, we can do business. So all of these things simultaneously are forcing even some of the countries that haven't had young leaders are having to do the same thing. If you look at a place like Tunisia or Egypt or other places in the region, Oman, they're all, to different degrees, doing similar things. So it's not just the fact that these are young leaders that is the reason for the change. The change is a structural response to really serious, almost existential challenges that almost all of the Arab countries are facing.
Rami Khoury writes the syndicated political column A View from the Arab World. He spoke to us early this morning from Amman, Jordan.